comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to Talk Radio Like Nowhere Else on Earth, the show where you matter. Wherever you happen to be seated all around this beautiful planet, or maybe you're standing, walking, or driving, I don't know what you're doing, but wherever you happen to be located all around this beautiful planet, thanks for being here at The Kevin Smith Show. I guess everyone around the world has heard the news that Richard Holbrooke, who has been really a pillar in the American diplomatic corps for many years, has passed away, and I wish to express my sympathy to the family. I got an email today from Ed in Pennsylvania who says, "I seem to remember seeing a picture of you with Mr. Holbrooke somewhere. Did you know him?" And the answer to that, Ed, is no. No. The picture you saw was when he visited Kosovo, and I was part of the meet and greet detail and the security around him. And so, yeah, there's a picture of me standing next to him. But did I know him? I spoke to him. He spoke to me, shook my hand. That's about it. I really didn't know him. But that's the picture you've seen. There's been some interesting news related to UFOs around the world. Saturday night over in China, there was another UFO over an airport causing flight delays. Actually, there were three planes that were not allowed to land for about an hour. Because of this UFO. It was over the airport at, I think it's pronounced Baotou, in Inner Mongolia. And three planes, as I say, were prevented from landing for almost an hour Saturday night. This was reported in the Shanghai Daily and also the People's Daily Online. Over in Japan, now this has been, I think it's been out on the on YouTube now for several days, but it's fairly recent, where there are videos of several unidentified flying objects that are hovering above a volcano in Japan called the Sakurajima volcano. So they're hovering above this volcano, and then there are some unexplained explosions and flashes of light behind the volcano. So, you know, that's a big mystery. A lot of people are wondering, what's that all about? We have another big mystery we're going to be talking about tonight. We've talked about it many times. We've looked at it from many, many different angles, and that is, where did we come from? My guest is going to be Aaron Kaplan, and he's been my guest before. He is the author of a book called Deep Analysis, Startling Conclusions. And he's come up with an addendum theory, if you will, and has talked with me about it. We will hear from him on the other side of this break. Well, my clock is wrong. We've got about 4 seconds left. So there we go. On the other side of this break, we'll continue with The Kevin Smith Show and my guest, Aaron Kaplan.
Come on.
All right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. I mentioned just a moment ago that my guest this evening is Aaron Kaplan. He has been my guest on this show before, and we discussed his book, Deep Analysis, Startling Conclusion. Aaron, let me just welcome you back to the show, and then I want to introduce you to folks who did not hear the first one or who have joined the show in the intervening time. So welcome back. We're glad to have you.
Thank you very much, Kevin, and thank you for having me on again.
All right. Okay, so for those of you, maybe you missed that previous show or you've just begun listening to the show since Aaron was on, or maybe you're like me and you just have a fuzzy memory. So let me tell you a little bit about Aaron. He attended and graduated from the Samuel James Tilden High School in Brooklyn, New York in 1964. He continued his education and graduated from the College of Aeronautics class of 1967 near LaGuardia Airport, Flushing, New York. He was employed for over 35 years in the aerospace aircraft industry in both civilian and military projects, and performed work on all types of aircraft, including designing major parts for jet engines, and that includes rights to a patent received from Pratt and Whitney in Hartford, Connecticut. He's also been employed by such other companies as Fairchild Republic, Grumman Aircraft, Sikorsky Helicopters, and he worked for the EDO Corporation, involving submarines and electro-visual engineering involving flight simulators, the newest 3D type. So as you can see, he's got quite a background in real high-tech stuff here. Aaron, when you were here with us last time, we discussed your book quite in detail. Tonight, you're here to present some new information to us, and based on what you've told me, I'd say it's going to be quite controversial. But before we get into that, I first would like, because I've just read to our audience your background, which is highly technical, so let's talk about you for just a moment. With your background in aeronautics, and especially with some of the world's top aeronautics firms, how did you get interested in things like the Anunnaki, Nephilim, and off-Earth life? How did you get into that?
Well, when I was very young in high school, my first few years in college, I was very interested in the sci-fi movies and UFOs and so forth, like most other people. And I attended small groups. You remember way back in the 60s, the group like MUFON and so forth. And they had meetings in New York City every few weeks, and watch movies about the missing aircraft, Bermuda Triangle, and the crash of Roswell. And I keep buying books, and every author promises, gives the word that if you buy the book, you'll get the answer. And I keep buying books and books and books, and I rarely get an answer. So I finally decided to do some research on my own. And it took me quite a few years, and one morning I woke up and it hit me right in the chin. And if you remember, my first answer was to the question of Roswell was DNA. And of course, DNA involves a lot of things, including the Anunnaki and the Nephilim and so forth and so forth. And the more research I was doing lately, the deeper I got involved, I'm finding out some very startling facts about who we are and where we came from. It's stunning.
Okay, now I understand that you have developed a theory related to the Garden of Eden. So let me ask first, the primary source for information about the Garden of Eden is Genesis in the Bible. How do you view the Bible?
I look at the Bible strictly as non-religious. I look at it as strictly as a history book and as a science book full of facts. But you have to be very careful how you put those facts all together. It seems that the last 1,000 or 2,000 years, many sects in our society, of all religions, Judaism, Christianity, even Muslims, have been trying somehow to hide certain facts behind certain words. And if you don't read it correctly, you wind up to be sort of strictly pro-religion, not knowing really what it means.
Okay, so you don't view the Bible, you don't view the Bible from a theological point of view.
That's correct. You have to be very careful how you read it. Okay. Have an open mind, and be very, very neutral.
All right. So would it be fair to say then, when we look at Genesis, you're looking at Genesis as merely an ancient document, and you just want to know, what does it say?
You're absolutely correct, Kevin.
All right. Let's get into the theory. And well, let me do this. Ladies and gentlemen, our audience is literally around the world. Now, we have people that listen to the show that are Jewish. We have people that listen to this show that are Christian. We have people that listen to this show who are Buddhist, who are Muslim, who are Hindu. Name it. It's out there. And then we have a bunch of folks that listen to the show that are not religious at all. There's no way that we could talk about what we're going to talk about tonight without it being controversial. We understand that. I've already warned Aaron that I will have probably some pretty tough questions. And the reason is because it is controversial. So we know that going into it. Aaron says he can roll with it. So, Aaron, what's the theory you've come up with?
The basic theory is that what I've been reading is there may have been two gardens of Eden. One here on planet Earth, and one on planet Mars.
One Garden of Eden on Earth, one Garden of Eden on Mars. Did they exist at the same time?
Almost. I believe, number one, that the Anunnaki race, which, according to a couple of big experts, have been around for over 45 million years as a race of aliens to us.
Mm-hmm.
I think their mission was, many million of years, to terraform planets. I believe the Anunnaki have terraformed our immediate galaxy here, where we live, especially Earth, the planet Earth, and Mars. However, I believe that Mars was terraformed first, and the Earth was terraformed second, maybe 10 to 20,000 years in between, roughly. But something happened. Something happened.
Okay, what happened?
Sort of a tragedy.
Yeah, what happened?
If many of you folks have read the works of people like Zacharias Sitkin or the book The 12 Planets, there are rumors that the planet was involved called Tiamat and exploded roughly 55,000 years ago. And, of course, it formed the famous asteroid belt. However, I believe personally that destruction of Tiamat was not caused by a satellite of any other planet or any natural occurrence. It was caused by use of a very, very humongous weapon. It's a two-part weapon called the Spear of Destiny and the Tablet of Destinies, which the gods have used. Now, when I say gods, I have to be very, very careful. I don't mean to say God with a capital G or a small g. Gods may have many meanings for our conversation. But just leave it as gods. It will be up to each individual to think of his own background. What I'm referring to are the ancient Sumerian gods called Enki, and Enlil, and Ishtar, and so forth. Enki had a son called Marduk. I believe that Marduk is the one that used the weapon, the Spear of Destiny, to destroy the planet Tiamat for two or three reasons. He suspected some foul play with the planet, but that's not the problem. The problem starts when he destroyed the planet Tiamat roughly 55,000 years ago. When that weapon was used, the planet exploded totally. It was mainly a water planet. However, a split second before the planet blew up, there was a possibility that the death rate from that weapon may have reflected with the waters of Tiamat and hit Mars by accident, or the death rate from the weapon went straight through the planet Tiamat and hit Mars. When it hit Mars, it did not destroy Mars, but it caused its waters to evaporate roughly the same time, about 55,000 years ago. And that planet Mars was inhabited by civilization very similar to ours. I believe the Anunnaki formed the same human being to Mars as it is on Earth. Mars was terraformed first, and life was created on Mars first. And roughly 10 to 15,000 years later, the Anunnaki formed life here on the planet Earth.
When I was reading books, okay, now let me ask you this. Why do you think this is the Anunnaki doing this?
They had a job. You remember the biblical entities called the cherubim, the ophanim, and the seraphim. Their basic job was to create life. According to the Sumerian tablets and all records other that we possess by now, the head of the seraphim, his name was Lucifer. Now, many people think Lucifer is a devil. He's not. He's a very highly skilled scientist who specializes in DNA. He's been around for millions of years. The Anunnaki have been given the task for millions of years of being in charge of those three angelic groups. I'm saying angelic because the Old Testament and the New Testament call them angels. But you can look at them just as alien entities. Those who work as a group form life by using DNA. This is basically their mission.
Okay. So the Anunnaki, if I understand what you're saying, created, using their skills with DNA, created life on Mars. They terraform Mars. They create life there. And then 10 to 12,000 years later, is that what you said? They did it on Earth. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. And then Mars gets hit with this unintended shot from this what do you call it? Spear of what?
Spear of destiny.
Okay, spear of destiny. Now, normally when we hear about the spear of destiny, we're talking about the spear of Longinus, or Longinus, who was the Roman soldier who shoved the spear into the side of Jesus as he hung on the cross. And so normally when we hear about the spear of destiny, that's what they're talking about. You obviously are talking about something else here.
That's correct. I'm talking about a two-part super weapon that has two names. Spear of destiny is where it's in conjunction with the tablet of destinies. It seems that the spear of destiny is the actual weapon, and the tablet of destiny is an old supercomputer that enables the sphere of destiny to operate and function.
Okay, now what's your source of information about that? Where can we find out about that?
You have to find out in very old Sumerian tablets, or read a book by experts such as one of them, the Goliath Sifting, which I read very carefully, and I tried to check his records with other writers, but there are very few people around that are knowledgeable with the Sumerian language. But many people basically agree with the Goliath Sifting with some disagreements. But basically, he's correct about certain things.
Let me... I've got time before the break. Let me throw this out. While I personally have some differences, translational differences, with Dr. Michael Heiser, still I give credit where credit is due, and he's a very, very smart man in ancient languages, and he's a professor of Hebrew and ancient languages at a university. And Dr. Michael Heiser has said on this show, he's also written about this, and I guess he has said it in other venues as well, that he has grave questions about some of Zechariah Sitchin's translations because they seem to be translations of Sumerian tablets that don't exist. No one has seen them. Now, is that something that you said that you kind of looked at Sitchin and tried to vet his information? Is that something you considered?
Yes, I tried to move it to other books. But again, you have to remember that the Goliath Sitchin is one of the few people in the world who seem to be an authority on Sumerian language. The fascinating thing about the Goliath Sitchin was that his first book was published around 1976, The 12 Planets. And for 20 years prior to that, he was doing a lot of digging in communist countries in Europe, in East Germany, where no one was allowed even inside. Yet he was let in, I believe, with the help of U.S. government agencies and with the okay of communist countries. So apparently they also thought much of him. They allowed him in. And later on, the other experts went to museums in East Germany, and many have verified his findings. Now, I did read the words of Michael Heiser.
Okay, tell you what, this is a good place for us to step back for just a moment because we have a break coming up. So I've made a note here. And when we come back from break, I want to hear what you had to say. You've read the books of Michael Heiser or the works of Michael Heiser. I'd like to hear what you have to say about that. And you present an interesting case here. That Sitchin got into places other people can't go, and maybe that's where he saw this information. Anyway, we'll be back right after this, so don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Aaron Kaplan. And Aaron, when we stepped away for break, I had asked the question about that Heiser, Dr. Michael Heiser, raised the issue with Sitchin about Sitchin having apparently translated some things from Sumerian tablets that apparently don't exist. And you were speaking to that point, and you said that he got into a whole lot of areas behind the Iron Curtain and did some of his studies that other people were not able to get into. And then you said, you started to say, you have read the works of Dr. Michael Heiser. So let's pick up there, and the microphone is yours.
The works I've read, Michael Heiser, I've also seen a few of his videotapes. He's a very detailed person. He likes to take a word and break it to its meaning. Like I watched them for 10 minutes try to explain the meaning of the word nachash.
Mm-hmm.
In Hebrew, nachash means a snake in the Garden of Eden. And he's a very detailed person. But sometimes when we get...
Well, actually, nachash means reptile. It can be applied to a snake, but it can be applied to any reptile.
And it could be also, you're right.
Mm-hmm.
And he tried to break it down to its meaning. Very, very detailed. Now, Uriah Sitkin, I think, is a small problem of security. And you have to be very careful. One place in his works, he writes very clearly that the spaceships of the Anunnaki are round, like a UFO, like a flying saucer, or whatever.
Okay.
Then a few chapters later, the same author, Brad Sitkin, writes down that the Anunnakis are coming down from Nibiru in rocket ships full of smoke and rocket engines and runways, blah, blah, blah. Now, you ask yourself a question. A race that's 45 million years old is not going to come to land on our planet with rocket ships. In my mind, that's a no-no. Giant UFOs? Sure, it's possible. Beam me up, Scotty method? Possible. Rocket ships? No.
So how do you account for that?
Pardon me?
How do you account for that, then?
He tried to be very careful the way he explained things and give us a hint what's going on. The reason why is 5-6 years ago, I don't know if the world is aware of it or anybody, the U.S. government actually brought a lawsuit against Uriah Sitkin. A very mysterious lawsuit that has no background. Basically, they tried to shut him up from revealing certain dates and certain information regarding the planet Nibiru. The actual arrival date. They actually wanted him to surrender all his data on the planet Nibiru. Written data, computer data, and so forth. I think he was aware of it for many years, and he knew the point would come to this point. So when he wrote his book, he wrote it in a way where if you're clever enough, you could tell right away what he's trying to tell you. Now, I didn't know about it until the crisis passed away, I believe, about 2 months ago. I myself was not aware of it. About a year and a half ago, 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I kept reading his books over and over again, and I went, oh my God, I know what he's trying to tell us now. But Karasik was a very sneaky man, very clever. Very clever. So.
Okay, so be specific. How was he being clever, and what was he trying to say?
What he was trying to say basically is, number one, rocket ships with flame and smoke, the one that landed supposedly in the plains of Nasdaq, in the Middle East, in the Sinai Desert, the spaceport of Sippur, and so forth, were not meant by the Anunnaki.
They were not what?
They were not manned or piloted by the Anunnaki.
Okay.
They may have had a few Anunnaki among them, the helpers. I'm sure they did. But they were manned, I believe, by the fleeing Martians, or not fleeing, I should say, the escaping Martians from Mars, roughly 50,000 years ago. It was a giant rescue operation effort to rescue as many Martians as possible when Mars lost its waters.
Okay, so were there humans on this planet when that event happened?
Yes. There were humans here, and humans came from Mars here at the same time. That's the reason, I believe, for the mass migration, roughly 45,000 years ago, from east to west. There are stories and records that Cro-Magnon men, modern men like us, fled from Central Europe to North America or South America through land masses that existed then. But nobody knew the reason or how. So many experts, like Michael Cremo, who wrote a book like Forbidden Archaeology, Lord Pye with Intervention Theory, they're all correct. But I believe that nobody really put on what's really going on. What happened is modern man, that's us, that lived here originally on planet Earth, which I call the first Garden of Eden, or the earthly one, they had to flee. Why? A new modern man arrived, also Cro-Magnon, but much smarter. They arrived with new weaponry, new sciences, new skills. They could not compete on the same grounds. They had to move. Most of them moved, I believe, to South America and North America. And the famous god that talked about many times, but not paid much attention to, his name is Quetzalcoatl, I believe was put in charge of the original Earthlings that lived on this planet, that fled to South America, or Central America.
Well, you know, there's a very interesting thing about Quetzalcoatl. He arrives in South America in the same year that the Egyptian god Thoth is banished or exiled from Egypt. Quetzalcoatl's sacred number is the same as Thoth, and his sacred symbols are the same. And so there's been a lot of speculation that this is the same individual.
It might very well be. Could you check the records of the god Quetzalcoatl? He hung around with the other gods. Those gods lived around 1500 BC, roughly. Not at 600 BC, like most books tell you. He disappeared right after. Right after the last intervention of Moses in the pyramids. Around 1588 BC.
All right, tell us about Moses. I see. I don't think most people think of Moses as being associated with the Great Pyramids. So, tell us, what's that connection?
Wow, that's great. I believe that Moses, when he escaped from Egypt the first time, was supposedly killing a guard. The story could be true, but he spent, if you remember, 40 years in the Midian desert. And that's where he met God by the burning bush. And God taught him many things. I believe that God trained him for a very special mission that is most people never heard of. The planet Nibiru was approaching. And I believe that the pyramids were built for a certain reason. Top of the pyramids, in the old story, the tip of the pyramid was made of gold, according to old records. And inside the king chamber of the pyramid, there is a certain coffer on the floor with the same exact measurements as the Ark of the Covenant. The same exact measurements. I believe that Moses was trained by the so-called God for a very special reason, which was to operate an Ark of a Covenant that already existed for at least 2,000 years inside the pyramid from a previous leader like Moses. That Ark of the Covenant powered a very strong power plant that created a very strong electric impulse to the top of the pyramid, supposedly to divert the planet Nibiru from hitting the Earth. A little nudge. The reason was to operate that Ark of the Covenant, a person had to have a certain blood type. A very specific DNA of the Ark of the Covenant could not operate.
Why?
That's why.
Why is that?
The reason was when those Nephilim fell down to Earth. They were banished here. I believe that a barrier exists around the Earth that prevents those Nephilim from escaping. It will hone in on their DNA, and if they try to escape, the barrier was erected by the Anunnaki. If they try to escape, that barrier will sense and destroy the DNA that those Nephilim have. Now, Moses did not have that DNA. When Moses climbed the mountain the first time by the burning bush, God told him specifically, I knew your forefathers. I knew Abraham, I knew Isaac, and Jacob. Which, it was the same exact bloodline from Noah. Which I believe Noah was not of this earth. He originated on Mars. Because remember, when the Nephilim fell to earth in the Book of Enoch, it specifically states that the Nephilim fell on Mount Hermon in the days of Jared. And Jared was right along the bloodline of Noah.
Okay, so what you're saying is that Noah is one of the people that came here from Mars.
That's correct. That's absolutely.
Now, would he be one of the people who came here from Mars, or would he be one of the descendants of people who came here from Mars?
It is one of the descendants.
Okay, he's one of the descendants. All right, we have to step away for break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're talking this evening with Aaron Kaplan. Aaron, as we went to break, I asked, is Noah one of the people who came from Mars or a descendant? And I believe you said he's a descendant of the people who came from Mars. Is that right?
That's correct. Let me read you 10 names. Adam, Seth, Enos, Canaan, Malhel, Jared, Enoch, Methuselah, Lamech, and Noah. Noah, the 10th descendant from Adam.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now, let me read you something that would be like a semi-knockout punch. Are you familiar with the book of Peter?
Yeah.
Peter 2.
Okay.
And Peter 2 is a very important verse that's hidden, buried, that nobody's paying attention to. That's a very big key. Let me read it.
Mm-hmm.
It's the second epistle of Peter, verse 5. Let me read that. And did not spare the ancient world, but saved Noah, one of eight people, a preacher of righteousness bringing in the flood on the world of the ungodly. Now, here it says one of eight people. Why does Peter say one of eight people if Noah is the 10th descendant from Adam? It's very tricky.
Well, you have Noah, his wife, his sons, and their wives.
Well, according to my theory, not exactly.
Okay, let's hear your theory.
There's a theory here that's fascinating. It has to do with the word patriarch. Now remember, Peter strictly was not Christian. He was still Jewish. He was educated with the same group at Jesus in very religious Hebrew schools. He learned sciences. I learned the Kabbalah. He learned all the Hebrew educations. But he knew something, I believe, that Jesus also knew. And that may have been the reason why all of them may have been persecuted by the Romans. And here it comes. Now, strictly speaking, it could be argued that Enoch and Lamech never held the status of patriarch, as they died prior to the death of their own fathers. So the 10 names that I read you, Noah is the 10th generation from Adam. However, if you remove these two names, which are not patriarch, then Peter is correct by saying, I did not spare the ancient world, but saved Noah, one of eight people. I believe that Peter knew exactly who Noah really was. He knew who he was.
And why is that important?
No, it sounds very strange the way I'm explaining it. But Peter had great knowledge of the sciences. Because he taught the Jewish way, patriarchs, what he was taught. He was not taught by any Christian school yet.
Mm-hmm.
Christianity is not started yet. So he must have known exactly who Noah was. And he's right, he was the eighth person being a patriarch. The other two people I read, Enoch and Lamech, were not patriarchs.
And why is that important?
It's very important because Peter basically is saying, hey boy, I know who Noah really was. He was from the planet Mars, a very righteous man with a very special bloodline.
But that's the point. I don't see the connection. Whenever you tell me that he's the eighth patriarch from Adam to Noah, that he's the eighth, I don't see how that's a connection to Mars.
Well, the connection is that Jared or Methuselah, Jared is stating in the book of Enoch, when the Nephilim fell to earth, it states specifically that it fell in time of Jared.
Okay, so that means Jared was already here.
That's right.
Okay.
They also knew Jared was exactly. Otherwise, one mentioned his name.
Okay.
He was a very important person.
All right.
And if you read even at the book of Zechariah Sitkin, I believe it's on page, I mean, it was a small quote, 411, he's specifically saying that 49,000 years ago, the reign of the Sudra, Noah, a faithful servant of Enki, begins. Noah was actually born 49,000 years ago. Not very recently. The question is, of course, where was Noah kept for 49,000 years? Well, the answer could be, even publications, whenever you read something, it says, Noah wasn't the abode of God. The word abode is used very often. Abode could be a spaceship or a space station or who knows what, really. God kept him around. But Methuselah, which is the grandson of Jared, spells the man of the missile. And Jared means the one who came down, who descended from the heavens. So you have to have a way of connecting all these names together.
Well, I'm having problems connecting it. That's it. I'm having a problem connecting. Look, you have Jared. And by the way, folks, if this seems difficult for you, the names we're mentioning are mentioned in the book of Genesis, in the Bible. They're also mentioned, some of the names are mentioned in Enoch, which is not in the Bible. And that's what we're talking about. But we're talking about the descendants of this person that we call Adam. Okay, so you got Jared. He's living here on earth, right? And then Noah is, I think, the grandson of Methuselah. Methuselah is the grandson of Jared. So you have Adam, and you come down to Jared, and then his grandson is Methuselah, who lives almost 1,000 years. His grandson is Noah. In the days of Jared, the book of Enoch says, that's when the Nephilim came down to earth. Okay, so that happened in the days of Jared. Noah is not around at that time. Because you have Jared, and then you have his grandson, Methuselah, and then you have his grandson, Noah. So Noah comes way after the days of Jared. So I still fail to see how this connects up to Mars.
It connects to Mars because that's when planet Tiamat exploded roughly 55,000 years ago. According to Sumerian tablets, Noah was born 49,000 years ago. If you take the lifespan of each person, roughly 900 years, roughly, in line, you get almost 9,000 years. If you add the 49,000 years, those amount of years, you get almost a day. Almost. The planet Tiamat blew up and Mars lost its waters. It's not exact science, but something's happening here.
Okay, so...
Numbers are trying to match together and blend in the right way.
But Noah is a descendant of Adam, and Adam is not from Mars.
Aha, that's the catch. That's why I'm claiming that there may have been two Gardens of Eden. Now we're back to my original claim. If you go to Genesis, chapter 1, it says, it says very clearly, God created man in his own image.
No, it doesn't. That's Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. And it's God's created. It's plural. It's Elohim. And just as cherubim, the I-M on the end is plural, then when you put the I-M on the end of Elohim, that's plural. So you have God's created man in his own, in their own image. In the image of God's created they, them. It's all plural.
Well, then, what I'm reading, let's say, chapter 1, verse 28, then God blessed them.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you something. In chapter 1, there are 31 verses. And the word God appears in the English translation 32 times in those 31 verses. But all 32 times, it is plural in Hebrew. We have to step away for a break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Aaron Kaplan. Let me welcome those of you who have joined us just now in this second hour. We are discussing, if you missed the first hour, boy, did you miss loads of information. But we're glad you're here now. And Aaron Kaplan is the author of a book called Deep Analysis, Startling Conclusions. And we're discussing a theory that he's got that there was once a population on Mars, which, by the way, let me say, there's a very sizable crowd of folks in the UFO community that think that's the case, that there was a civilization on Mars. And but what his theory is that there were possibly two so-called Gardens of Eden. But Aaron, we were talking about this first chapter of Genesis. All the way through there, it's gods. It's plural. And you go through all 6 days, and then on the seventh day, Elohim, gods, rested. And then sometime after that seventh day, you have Yahweh Elohim, the Elohim, that shows up and does the creation of Adam. And so you have two separate human races going there. That first human race created by the Elohim, they don't get the breath of life. They're told to be fruitful and multiply, and they're told to go forage throughout the earth. But when Yahweh Elohim shows up, the boss god, when he shows up and creates Adam, Adam gets this breath of life, and by the way, the terminology used for he breathed into him the breath of life is the word for either ejaculate or inject the breath of life into Adam. And then from Adam, he takes a rib and does genetic engineering and makes Eve. Adam and Eve are not told to go forage. They are told to eat what's in the garden, which, by the way, Adam was created and living, and then the garden was planted by Yahweh Elohim. And when the garden grew up into fruition, he placed Adam into the garden, and then he creates Eve. He tells them to stay in the garden, eat what's here, and he never tells them to be fruitful and multiply. So you've got a whole two different sets of humans running around on the earth at that point. You have the ones created by the Elohim, and then the ones created by the boss Elohim.
What you're saying so far, Kevin, absolutely correct. I'm trying to use the word God, or I have the Hebrew Bible right in front of me, and you're right, it's Elohim, Adonai, Yehovah. But I'm trying to stay away from that. I'm trying to use the word God as a creator.
Yeah, but you've got two different creators there, and you have two different creation events for two different human races.
You're getting very close. In chapter 1, there's no mention of any of Adam or Eve or Jared, anybody.
Mm-hmm.
The so-called God creates life forms. He creates them. And in verse 28 of chapter 1, the so-called God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply.
Yeah, but my point is it's not the so-called God. It's gods.
Gods. Fine. Mm-hmm. I'm with you, but I'm trying very hard to leave a small detail out of religious so it won't confuse the issue.
Well, it's not religious. No. It's not religious at all. Genesis says what it says, not what people want it to say.
I'm with you. You're
okay?
Right.
It just says what it says. And so what you've got is the first 6 days being done by the gods, at least according to the Hebrew text. And then after the seventh day, you have the boss god, which is exactly what Adonai means. It means Lord, and people have assigned in the West, they've assigned that some kind of religious meaning. It's not. It's a political title. You're a Lord because you've been appointed so. And it's a political title. It means you are the boss. And so the boss God shows up. And if you look at chapter 2 of Genesis, all the way through chapter 2, the only place you see the Elohim is right at the beginning where they rested on the seventh day, and they're finished. They never show up in chapter 2 after that. But the boss God does. Their boss shows up. Their king shows up. And he says, there's not a man to till the ground. He didn't say there's not a man. There were. He said there's not one smart enough for agriculture. So he creates one. And then he plants a garden. He puts him in it. And then he creates from his bone marrow. He does genetic engineering. It doesn't use that terminology, but it describes it. And from that, he builds a woman that we refer to as Eve. So now you have this race created by the boss God living in the garden. Outside the garden, you've got what I refer to as dirt people. They're just made from the dirt of the ground. They didn't get the breath of life. Whatever that is, they didn't get it. Adam and Eve got it. And, you know, their diet is different. Their job description is different. The job description of the people created by the gods in chapter 1, their job description is have sex and make babies. Adam and Eve are never told that.
Kevin, you're absolutely correct again. What you just described is one very distinct possibility.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you 100%. Now, what I'm going to do is give you a twist of my or second possibility. This is my theory.
Mm-hmm.
This may be correct. So, just do what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at the end of chapter 1, the so-called God, verse 31 says, then God saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was very good. But he was satisfied. So the evening and the morning were the sixth day. So God basically saying, when he created first in chapter 1, he's satisfied.
And well, let's be more specific. The gods were satisfied with what they had done. But apparently their boss was not.
Okay, fine. Let's say you were correct. Now, let's go to chapter 2.
Mm-hmm.
Verse 4.
All right.
Suddenly, it said as follows. This is the history of the heavens and the earth when they were created. He's not saying the earth only. He's saying the heavens and the earth.
Mm-hmm.
In the day that the Lord God made the earth and the heavens. So it may be referring to here, maybe, I'm saying maybe, not only our planets.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying maybe. There's not a possibility.
Well, he's quite definitely, look, when he says the heavens, that's what we would refer to as the universe. So the heavens out there. The heavens, as that word is used, it's the way they would describe what we refer to when we say the universe. But now let me throw this in and then continue. In Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, it says, "In the beginning, God's created the heavens and the earth." But the first day of those 6 days of creation in which the Elohim, the gods, are doing things, does not start till verse 3. The earth existed prior to those 6 days of creation, and it could have existed for billions of years prior.
So far I'm with you, Kevin.
Okay. So there could have been on this planet many civilizations prior to this story that we're dealing with in Genesis. And what I'm leading up to here is that Noah, the Nephilim came to earth according to the book of Enoch, which is, folks, not in the Bible, but was widely accepted by the Jewish people right up into and after the time of Jesus. And in fact, in the early Christian church, it was accepted as scripture, but it somehow it didn't make the cut whenever they decided they were going to put together what we call the Bible. But Enoch says, as you correctly stated, Aaron, that these Nephilim came to earth in the days of Jared. It also says that they looked around and they said, hey, look at all these earth women. They're pretty good looking chicks. And so by whatever means, rape or marriage or whatever, it says they just took whatever women they wanted and these women bore children to them. Okay, now if that's going on, what you're talking about there is a extraterrestrial human hybrid program taking place. But Noah was chosen specifically when that flood came, according to Genesis. He was chosen not because he was a good man, but because his pedigree had no Nephilim blood in it. His pedigree, his genealogy was pure. It says that he was perfect in his generations. So he was picked because he was not part Nephilim.
Kevin, you're exactly correct. You're right on. Not only, if my theory is correct, only if I'm correct, not only was Noah DNA not Nephilim, but there's a very possibility that God called him a righteous man because his DNA was double pure, maybe from the planet Mars, maybe. Now, chapter 2 suddenly says, suddenly, God is creating again all men, creating men and women. This time he's giving them names, which he hasn't done in the beginning.
Mm-hmm. That's because he didn't do the ones in the beginning.
Here's the catch. In chapter 3, verse 24, we have this statement. So we drove out the men, and he placed cherubim to the east of the Garden of Eden. The flaming sword, which turned every way, guard the way to the tree of life. Now, the way I'm looking at it, my theory is the original God that created life on earth and was contaminated by the Nephilim was caught off guard. So Earth is already contaminated. Now on the planet Mars, he's being very careful. They're putting a gate in the barn after the horse ran away. He's now making sure that the DNA on planet Mars will not be contaminated. He's placing cherubim in the Garden of Eden on Mars to guard him, making sure there'll be no contamination on planet Mars.
Do you you read Hebrew, don't you?
Yes.
Do you have your Hebrew version of Genesis right in front of you?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Go back to the verse where it says God says he's got to kick man out of the garden.
Oh, there's quite a few of them. I wonder which one you refer to exactly.
Well, I don't remember the address, but it says, in English, it says, and the Lord God said, now the man has become as one of us. But in Hebrew, it doesn't say that. It says, now the man has become us. He has become one of us. Not as one of us. He has become one of us. Adam and Eve were expelled from the garden because they had become Elohim. And he says, lest he now reach forth his hand and take from the tree of life. Well, the tree of life is a metaphor that's used in almost all the ancient texts for what today we refer to as DNA. So I think you may be onto something there.
Well, if you keep on going to chapter 5, verse 29.
All right.
Here's a possible real clue. Chapter 5, verse 29.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is a statement by Lamech, Noah's father. And Lamech states, and he called his name Noah, saying, this one will comfort us concerning our work and the toil of our hands, because of the ground the Lord has cursed. Now, why would Lamech suddenly say that for no reason? Something is going on here. My theory is, the way I'm thinking, that when the Martians arrived here to this planet, things changed for them. It's like us changing neighborhoods or moving from one building to another, from one country to another. But here's worse. The gravity on planet Mars is roughly 38% of that of Earth.
All right.
If humans came from the planet Mars to Earth to survive, they had no choice. They had no choice. They had to come here. They would complain because everything is becoming very hard for them because gravity is doubled. Very difficult. Like I said, it's a very distinct possibility, not a fact. They're complaining. What are we doing here? It's so difficult. It's so hard. Why are we here?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a very important clue. Remember, this was not said after the deluge. This was said in the days of Lamech and Jared. Roughly, all the dates of all the records are correct, roughly 48, 49,000 years ago. Why make a statement suddenly, out of nowhere? Doesn't belong here. Unless things are very, very hard for them that they're not used to.
Let me tell you, one of the explanations that I have read about that, they say that when Adam and Eve ate off of that tree in the garden, and God punished them with Eve. A very interesting thing about Eve. Her punishment was, you're going to become a baby factory, and you're going to have one kid after another, and yet your desire will be to your husband. In other words, he switched her on where basically she was a sex addict. And even though she was having one kid after another, and it was extremely painful and difficult for her, she just couldn't stay away from Adam. Now, that's not something churches usually teach, but hey, that's in the script there. It's in Genesis, and I didn't write the script. It's there. Now, what he told Adam was, the ground is cursed for your sake, and it's going to be very difficult for you. And remember, it states in Genesis chapter 2 that the very purpose for which Adam was created was agriculture. And now he says the ground is cursed for your sake, and it's going to be very tough for you to grow any crops. And a lot of people say, well, that's why Lamech said what he said about all of the toils and the difficulties. But I don't think so. And the reason I don't think so is because the ground wasn't cursed for Adam's son, Cain. He was a farmer and was very successful as a farmer, and it brought a bountiful sacrifice of his crops, you see. So Adam wasn't doing very well at farming, but Cain did. So the curse didn't carry over into the children. It was a curse or a punishment for Adam. Therefore, you can't say that Lamech said what he said as a result of Adam's curse. So you may, like I say, you may be on to something here. I think there certainly is something more going on than what usually gets discussed. I think there's more going on there than really perhaps that I had thought about. I've wondered about that statement by Noah's granddad, but and I couldn't really make it fit. But like you say, if they came here from somewhere else, then if they came here from Mars, then it would be very difficult for them. So are you saying that Adam was actually created over on Mars?
Right. The names that are mentioned in this chapter suddenly out of nowhere, they were not mentioned in chapter 1.
Mm-hmm.
I believe these names belong the bloodline of Noah mm-hmm. to Adam on the planet Mars.
Interestingly, Adam is actually Adam, and Adam means red man. And it says he was created from the clay, and his name Adam actually means red man.
That's correct. Now, you take all the information that I gave you in consideration, the way I think, the way my mind works, I'll give you one more. In my book on page 160, you've seen the picture, I'm sure, many times, called The Picture of the Temple at Abydos.
Yeah.
Where it shows a helicopter, a jet plane, a UFO, a tank, and a submarine.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you something that nobody's ever told you. Right in the middle of the picture, but under the helicopter picture, if you're looking at it, I'm not sure if you are. That's in my book at page 160. But two words written. Oh, it seems like two words. I've heard many experts try to decipher those two words, including Dr. Dain Hawass.
Uh-huh.
And I'm getting very strange interpretations. Some says, I said, this belonged to the sister of my brother's sister. No. I believe that a few months ago, I deciphered exactly what those two words mean. The bottom word, which contains four letters.
Okay, let me ask you to hold off on that, because we have to take a break. And this is a good spot for us to back up. And when we come back, we'll dive right into what those two words mean. And I'm very familiar with the picture you're talking about. And folks, you've seen us talk about it here, and you've seen me show it here on the website and on our TV channel. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Aaron Kaplan. And Aaron, when we went away, you were just about to tell us something. Now, folks, just to refresh your memory, he was talking about this photograph of a carving in a frieze across the top of the inside of a temple at Abydos. And you've seen it. It's got very clearly on there what looks like a helicopter something that looks like a submarine, something that looks like a jet, something that looks like a UFO. And he says there's two words right in the middle of it, and you were just about to tell us what those two words are all about.
Yes, Kevin. Not bragging, but I believe that through coincidence or an accident, staring this picture for so long and thinking the way I'm thinking, I interpreted at least one word. The bottom word is right under the helicopter, and to the left of the tail of the jet aircraft consists of four letters. The first letter from right to left is het, is the Hebrew het. The second letter is the Hebrew vav. The third letter is the Hebrew lamed, L. And the fourth letter is the Hebrew mem sufit. It's an M used for the end of a word. If you spell the whole thing correctly, it spells olam. That's exactly what it's spelled, folks. It's olam. It's a Hebrew word. Nobody's ever brought it up before.
And what's the meaning of that word?
It's a very strange meaning. It's a mixture of Sumerian and Hebrew. I'll tell you what it means. In the ancient language, the planet Mars was born the planet of war. And this word Cholam could very well come from the source of Lahamu. Lahamu was a Sumerian Akkadian word for war. This may very well say that we are from Mars or our Mars. The word in the middle, right under the helicopter, two letters, I have no idea what it means. But I'm pretty positive, well, I can say positive. According to my way of thinking, the bottom word definitely means Mars. So if this picture is correct, if it is correct, and if my way of thinking is correct, but only if I'm correct, then these flying vehicles or mechanical vehicles may have been brought from Mars by coming Martians. They may have lasted for a long time until they rusted out or they just couldn't maintain them anymore. This tablet plate was hidden. At Temple of Abydos, on top of the ceiling behind another plate. When that other plate fell down on the floor, it exposed this plate.
Yeah.
The actual temple, I believe, is only 5,000 to 7,000 years old. But this plate, I understand, is much older. Nobody's really checked the date of the plate. But I'll tell you what, folks. These bottom words, they're definitely four Hebrew letters. Het, Vav, Lamed, Mem. And I can't say positively because I'm not a super expert on alphabet, but if the meaning of Lahamu is correct, being Mars, the planet of war, the part of the sentence means Mars something. Is it my Mars or we are for Mars or something of that sort?
Well, you know, that's interesting. Well, that's something I had not heard, but I have heard from a number of sources, actually, that the word Cairo, which of course is the name of the capital city of Egypt, Cairo in Egyptian means Mars.
That's correct. So we have in this picture something phenomenal. Now, if you think this is phenomenal, listen to my last evidence. You may have heard it, or you may have not. There's a cave in Hunan, China. And with a giant cave painting. That painting has been examined by Chinese experts and Russian experts.
Okay.
They dated it, listen to this, to exactly 49,000 years ago. Carbon 14. Now, that painting shows, painting or carving, whichever you want to look at, I haven't seen it personally. That painting shows a phenomenal picture. It shows men in spacesuits jumping on looks like barrels or platforms on top of water. Either with wetsuits or spacesuits. But that's not the phenomenal part. The phenomenal part is right to the lower right of that main cave painting is another painting. And here's the shocker. That painting is a partial painting of our galaxy. Sun, the Earth, Mars, so forth. It shows the Sun, the center is a large circle. Then it shows four planets in line. The first two planets are shown with a circle, the hollow center. The third planet, which is Earth, shown with a cross in the center. And the fourth planet, which is supposed to be Mars, is shown with a sort of a kind of a crack in the middle. Folks, I'll tell you what. I'm willing to bet what this painting is trying to tell us is that these inhabitants that landed in the water in China roughly 49,000 years ago came from the fourth planet to the third planet. That's the way I interpret it. I may be wrong.
Well, I'll tell you what. This is one of the things that is a lost art, and one of the things this show is dedicated to is giving folks the opportunity to think out loud and to say what you think. And I would like to invite our audience to do the same. I'd like to invite our audience to give us a call and join the conversation. The telephone number, folks, is 623-444-5889. That number will work from anywhere on this planet and possibly from Mars. But no matter where you are, you can give us a call at that number, 623-444-5889. If you're in the USA or Canada, and you need to call me on a toll-free line, you can do that. It is 888-223-4599. If you're outside of the USA and you're outside of Canada, I don't have a toll-free line out there, but what I do have for you is on my website. Go to kevinsmithshow.com, scroll down, you'll see the picture about tonight's show, and to the right of it, you'll see a link that says Flash message, so you can click that and send me your thoughts, your comments that way, and I'll be more than happy to read them on the air, provided they pertain to tonight's show. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
It's Francois from Montreal.
Hello, Francois.
Hi, Kevin. Hi, Aaron.
Hello, how are you?
Oh, I'm very fine. I just want to make a comment, when I heard about Zakaria Sitchin, I searched on the net for a dictionary of their language to English, and they contain just like 600 words. So I guess, and I talked with a lady of an Egyptologist. And she said that the Egyptian language is just deciphered 50 to 60%. And I talk with people like that can read the Sanskrit. Mm-hmm. And they told me like they can read it, but everyone doesn't remember how to pronounce it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's about it.
Well, and see, that happens with every language. Have you ever, Francois, you've seen, I'll just give you an example here. You've seen a Bible, right?
Yep.
Okay, and you've seen the version that they call the King James Version.
Actually, you know, like I noticed I speak French and I called.
Okay, so you've seen a French version. Well, I'm unfortunately going to use the King James as an example. Okay, hold up, Francois. All right, the deal with the King James Bible that a lot of people in the English-speaking world carry the King James Version, and there are even sects within Western Christianity that think that is the only version that is approved by God. And yet that's not what they're not carrying the King James. That's the King James Fourth Revision. The actual King James, if you look at it, the typeface is, for instance, an S within the middle of a word, looks like our letter F. And many of the words, the spelling of them, is more like German than it is like English. And so languages do change. Most people, if they ever see a King James, would not be able to read it. But languages change, and the way things were pronounced, we forget. I mean, is it a bath or a bath? Tomato, tomato.
I don't have under the band, but I have a translation of Genesis from French, from Hebrew to French, you know, like those books of the Krishna consciences.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, like they do stage by stage pronunciation. And when you get to French, you know, it says like God and, you know, like and things like that, and often the story is very different than what I can read in the French Bible.
Sure it is. When you read the actual words, you are reading a translation. But you'll notice there is the little word version. If you look at your French Bible, it'll say, I don't know what version it says, but it'll say the something version, the King James version, the Douay version. That's because that was produced by theologians who have filtered it according to their theological beliefs. But when you read, what you're talking about is actually called either a parallel or interlinear Bible. That's where you have it in the Hebrew, and then the translation directly under it or beside it. And the translation, word by word, gives you a whole different idea of what's being said.
Okay. Thank you. Have a nice evening.
All right. And see, that's... and let me make a point, Aaron, about that. In the first chapter of Genesis, as we were talking about, there are 31 verses. 32 times the word Elohim appears, and that is definitely plural. The I-M is just like putting an S on the end of an English word. It's Elohim. But in all the English translations, they translate it as God, singular. Why? Well, because that fits their theology, but that isn't what it says. We'll be back right after this. To the Kevin Smith Show. Folks all around the world are on the edge of their seats. I can see you through my microphone. Some of you are gritting your teeth at everything Aaron has had to say. Some of you are gritting your teeth at everything I have said. And that's what controversy is about. But you know something, folks. There are no new truths. Whatever is true has always been true and always will be true. But there's new discovery of truths that we didn't know. And all of it requires a lot of controversial thinking and talking. And I invite you to do a little thinking and a little talking with us at 623-444-5889. Love to hear from you. What's on your mind? Aaron, let me propose a possibility. Let me just see what you think about it. Are you up to that? Hello, Aaron.
I'm here. It's a very close thought.
Yeah, let me propose a possibility here. Maybe there are not two Gardens of Eden. Maybe there's only one, and it was on Mars. What do you think of that? Is that possible? I'm not saying that I think that's the case. I'm just wondering, is it possible that the whole Garden of Eden thing began on Mars?
It's very, very possible. Very possible. The only thing that makes me think there were two of them is the God, was the court who was put in charge of the primitive Cro-Magnon in Central America, and they were driven out by some newer arrivals, Cro-Magnon men, that settled in the Middle East and Europe. Something drove them out, scared them off. That's what I'm looking at.
Yeah. Well, it certainly is a mystery, but I think one thing we can settle upon for sure is whatever happened is quite a bit different from what we've been told happened. Let's go to the telephone and caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Brent from Wyoming.
Hi, Brent.
I'm going to postulate something for you.
Do that. Let's have some postulation going on.
Why one or two Gardens of Eden? Why not one per planet where civilization is planted?
Okay, Aaron. I'll punt. I'll let you answer that one.
His answer is correct. He hit it right in the head. Mm-hmm. One Garden of Eden per planet. That's what my findings are. One was made here on Earth, and one was made on Mars. The only thing that happened on planet Mars, that a disaster happened there. Mm-hmm. Something happened.
So what you're saying is Mars
lost its waters, and they had to escape somewhere. But the Martians escaped to the planet Earth. But you're saying it's correct. One per planet. You're absolutely correct.
In other words, what I'm postulating is that the Garden of Eden serves essentially as an incubator society until the society develops to a stage it can leave.
Yeah, but in this case, the Martians had to leave. They were forced to leave. They have no choice. What I found out is Mars, planet Mars lost its waters due to a tragedy roughly 55,000 years ago. They had to escape quick. So it came to Earth. Conditions were very similar.
Okay. That's my postulate for you, Kevin.
Well, I think you did well with it, and it's a good thought. You know, look, it's possible. Brent, you've been listening to this show a long time, and you've heard guests come on this show who have said that there is life, intelligent life, on every planet in our solar system. Now, there are a lot of people that find that extremely difficult to believe. I don't. I'm not saying I believe it. I'm saying I don't find that it's implausible. Because I could not breathe methane on Titan and live in those temperatures doesn't mean that life there would not have developed where it can. And to them, that's normal. And by the way, Brent, NASA revealed today that Titan has the building blocks of life, and under certain conditions, their atmosphere converts to oxygen. So maybe someday we might visit Titan.
Yep.
Yeah, thanks for the call.
All right. Goodbye.
All right. 623-444-5889. If you call, like, right now, I can take the call. But if you wait even a minute, I won't have the time. Because the end of the show is coming. Aaron, when I spoke to you about being on the show, I said to you, you got to be aware that what you're saying is highly controversial. And you said you were aware of that. Does that bother you?
Not at all. It's the whole theory of truth is controversy.
Yeah.
It's a debate to get to the truth.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's controversial to every mainstream theology. It is also very controversial for most scientists. And I think for a great many people in the UFO community, they would say it's controversial because a lot of folks in the UFO community are bent towards either, you know, some particular theology, or they are bent towards some particular theory of science. I myself am quite comfortable saying I don't know. You know, I think it's fun to look at the documents and see what the documents actually say, which is very different from what the churches and the rabbis, most of them, teach us. So the documents are very different in what they actually say than what we've been told. And I think it's fun to look at that and to speculate, but I can say I know what they say. I know for sure what they say. What does all that mean? I don't know. I speculate. And I think, to your credit, you have called this your theory, because there are parts of it where you said, this is my theory. This is what I think. And I think that's to your credit. I want to thank you for being with us tonight, Aaron. If you will, stay on the phone with me for just a moment. Ladies and gentlemen, if you click Aaron's picture on my website, it will take you to his website. And it's quite an interesting website and extremely well done. I invite you to click it and visit his website. Take a look at the information that's there. I also encourage you to get his book and read it, although he hasn't been here hawking his book tonight. I've read it, and I encourage you to read it. I think you'll find it's a very interesting read. I think you will find that it's a kind of a mind blower in some respects. Tomorrow night, we're going open line. So whatever it is that's on your mind, bring your own topic, and we want to hear from you, all right? My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do, too. You can call me whatever you wish to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.